But during these times, it's always good, as any other time, to refer ourselves and our heart.
The headlines. A senior Iranian commander says the Israeli regime will be forced to leave the occupied Palestinian territories in a humiliating way. In Canada, a mass grave containing remains of 215 children has been found at the site of a former residential school for Indigenous children. And Colombia's president orders the deployment of the military in the country's third largest city, Cali, amid renewed deadly anti-government protests. Commander of the Quds Force of Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says that new Palestinian generations must make a plan on running the whole Palestinian territories based on the pre-1967 border. Brigadier General Ismail Ghani says such a plan is backed by the International Resistance Front and the Islamic Revolution. He said that running the whole territories by the Palestinians is a divine promise that will happen in the near future. He also hailed the Palestinian youth for producing resources inside the country that have helped them in their resistance against Israel. He underlined that the Israeli regime will be forced to leave the occupied territories in a humiliating way. A funeral procession has been held in the city of Nablus in the occupied West Bank for a Palestinian gunned down by Israeli forces during protests against settlement expansion. The funeral was held in the village of Beta, where 28-year-old Zakaria Hamayel was shot dead by Israeli troops. He was struck by a bullet in the chest. Hamayel was among a group of Palestinians protesting the expansion of Israeli settlements. Dozens of demonstrators were also wounded by Israeli forces. In recent weeks, tensions have been running high in the occupied territories as Israel has intensified its crackdown against Palestinian protesters. The Palestinians are outraged at the regime's eviction plan in a Jerusalem Outpost neighborhood and its restrictions at the Al-Aqsa Mosque there. The recent deadly Israeli aggression against the Gaza Strip has also added to the Palestinians' anger. Campaigning is underway for Iran's presidential election as the seven candidates vying for the top executive post lay out ideas and plans to settle national challenges. The candidates have started appearing on TV and radio channels as part of efforts to woo voters. Campaigns are expected to mainly go on through TV channels and social media platforms because of the pandemic. The Iranian Interior Ministry, which organizes the June 18 vote, has discouraged fanfare in the streets. However, campaign posters and banners of the candidates have already gone up in Tehran and other cities. As the vote is approaching, the hopefuls are unveiling their plans aimed at resolving the issues that the country is facing. The plans mainly focus on the economy.
Saeed Jadidi is among the seven candidates approved by Iran's Constitutional Council to run for president. He says if elected president, his administration will try hard to make an economic leap. Jalili has also pledged to resolve unemployment and create more jobs.
We have held over the past years numerous sessions with different teams, including experts, university professors, and successful managers. Following all those talks, we have come up with a plan by the name of employment. It calls for creating as many jobs as we can in accordance with the country's capabilities and requirements, and at least in organizations under the supervision of the president.
Mohsen Rezaei is another candidate approved by the Constitutional Council for the June presidential vote. The 66-year-old hopeful has pledged to focus on economy. He says he will bring economic stability in the first 3 months of his administration. Rezaei says in order for the goal to be achieved, he will present plans that will control and stabilize prices. Ebrahim Raisi, who is currently the judiciary chief, has promised to bring economic prosperity too. Raisi has also vowed to take measures to reduce the cost of treatment as part of his plan for the health sector.
It should be possible for the government to reduce the cost of treatment by up to 50% for families, and this is quite doable. Since the Iranian health staff are experienced, people do not have to worry about their health treatment.
Presidential candidate Ali Reza Zakani says the top priority of his administration will be the removal of U.S. sanctions that have directly targeted ordinary Iranians. Another candidate, Amir Hussein Ghazizadeh Hashemi, has also spoken of plans by his administration and has presented them in a three-volume booklet.
The first volume is about the causes and effects of the problems the country is facing to exactly find out where we have problems. The second volume offers solutions to the problems we detect. There has to be a paradigm shift in order to resolve them.
Mohsen Mehralizadeh, the other presidential candidate, says his future government's plan will include those working on a transparent economy. He says people should be informed of the results of economic activities and whether or not those activities produce any results. The reformist politician says he has drawn up a long-term political and social plan for governing the country. Abdel Nasser Hemmeti is another candidate hoping to win the presidency. He is currently serving as the governor of Iran's central bank. Hemmeti is strongly critical of the current situation and says his government will be the representative of the majority of people whose voices have not been heard.
The government that I'm planning to form is called the Administration of the Third Voice. Both principalists and reformists can be part of my future administration.
Hemmeti says his main concern is the economy and people's livelihood. He says he has drawn up a comprehensive plan and that his goals can be achieved through construction interaction, among other things. Iranians will go to the polls on June 18 to choose a new president for the next 4 years. Economy is a major issue because things have got hard for the Iranians in the past several years following the 2018 withdrawal of the U.S. from the nuclear deal and the reimposition of the sanctions that have hit Iran's economy.
Iran's presidential candidate Ebrahim Raisi has called on the young generation to participate in the upcoming election with hope. He said the participation of youth in the electoral process will create a bright future for economic independence and prosperity. He said that young people are a great asset and can play a productive role in different fields. The presidential candidate said that the youth must be trusted by letting them determine their own future and to resolve social issues. Raisi currently serves as head of the Iranian judiciary and is among the seven hopefuls approved by the Constitutional Council to run for the presidency in the June 18th election. Iran's Election Commission says polling stations for the presidential vote will increase by 10,000 to avoid crowds amid the pandemic. The commission says with that increase, the number of polling places will top 70,000 across the country. Coronavirus concerns have prompted the commission to prohibit electoral rallies as well as debates and public addresses in closed spaces. Iran's Election Commission has also banned welcoming ceremonies, among other events, to avoid crowds. It says observing health protocols is mandatory, and anyone violating the rules will face punitive measures. Around 59 million Iranians are eligible to cast ballots in the presidential vote. Of them, over 1.3 million are first-time voters. In Canada, a mass grave containing remains of 215 children, some as young as 3 years old, has been found, with Prime Minister Justin Trudeau describing the discovery as heartbreaking. The remains were unearthed at the site of a former residential school for Indigenous children near the town of Kamloops in British Columbia. The bodies belong to the students of the school, but authorities say that the cause and timing of their deaths are not known yet. The Kamloops Indian Residential School was established in 1890 and closed in 1978. A 2015 investigation to Canada's residential school system concluded that the system, typically run by Christian churches, constituted cultural genocide. The report documented physical abuse, rape, malnutrition, and other atrocities against the school children. It also found that more than 4,000 children died while attending these schools. International human rights lawyer Edward Corrigan says the discovery of bodies of Indigenous students at a former Canadian school is another example of the country's historical anti-Indigenous campaign.
But this was a cover-up. You know, when 215 people die in any sort of institution, you know, there should have been an investigation, but they're buried in secret on the property of the school. And this is, you know, is a terrible situation. In some ways, unfortunately, the people who probably buried the bodies and committed the crimes are no longer here. But the community is owes a debt to the families and to these native communities that suffered horrifically. And, you know, this has been a, you know, several hundred year campaign of cultural and even physical genocide against the native population in Canada.
Colombian President Iván Duque says that he is deploying military troops in the country's third largest city, Cali, amid deadly anti-government protests there.
partir de esta noche.
We have seen acts of vandalism and we have seen acts against public infrastructure. I want to make it absolutely clear. From tonight begins the maximum deployment of military assistance to the National Police in Cali and the province of Valle. This deployment will be headed by experienced officials.
Duque took the decision after four people died during protests in Cali on Friday. The deaths came as tens of thousands marched across Colombia to make a month of anti-government demonstrations. Officials linked the fatalities to civilian shootings. Police fired tear gas and water cannon to disperse the protesters, and there have been reports of clashes between the two sides. The nationwide protests in Colombia started last month by unions against tax reforms, but have since expanded to wide-ranging demands. The protesters say that they will continue their street rallies until their demands are met. The unrest has so far claimed dozens of lives in the Latin American country. The U.S. has announced it will impose sanctions on Belarus over the diversion of a European passenger plane and the arrest of an opposition figure on board. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki has described last week's forced landing of a Lithuania-bound plane as a breach of international norms. She says the U.S. is working with the European Union on a list of sanctions against key members of the Belarusian government. The EU has already introduced economic sanctions, urging its allies to avoid Belarus airspace. Belarusian President Alexander Lukashenko has accused the West of trying to provoke unrest in his country. He made the comment while meeting with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, in the Russian resort city of Sochi. Putin has played down the controversy over the incident as, quote, a surge of emotions. Brian Berletet is an independent geopolitical analyst who joins us to tell us more about this. Brian, do you agree with what the Russian president has said, that this is just a surge of emotions?
It is, and it's also supreme hypocrisy on America's part, because America is claiming that this is a breach of international norms, but if you follow the actions of the United States back in 2013, they did precisely this in their efforts to catch Edward Snowden. They actually forced down the plane of Bolivian President Evo Morales. So if Belarus thought that this was acceptable behavior, it's only because they saw the U.S. do it first.
Well, what is the underlying reason overall? What is the U.S. trying to prove by doing this? And also, of course, we can have your say on the EU and the way it has reacted to this.
This reaction to this incident is just a pretext. It's the incident itself is a pretext for the U.S. and the EU to put more pressure on the government of Belarus. This is U.S. and EU-backed regime change in motion. The so-called activist that was arrested, this Roman Protasevich, he was working with the U.S. government. He was working with their Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, and he had his own opposition media platform also funded by the U.S. government. He also traveled to Ukraine and joined a neo-Nazi militia, the Azov Battalion. So this man was an obvious threat to Belarus's national security. If international law worked the way that it was supposed to, he should have been wanted by Interpol, and he shouldn't have been able to travel anywhere without being arrested.
Okay, thank you very much for that, Brian Berletich, independent geopolitical analyst. Thank you. On to the UK. The police crime sentencing and courts bill there is close to becoming law, with the government arguing that they need more power to break down unlawful protests. Now, opponents to the move maintain that the plans in reality will target civil liberties, the legitimate right to protest, and the right of assembly, which many argue should be a cornerstone of British democracy. Our UK correspondent Richard Sudan has more.
Activists are galvanizing opposition to the government's planned controversial policing bill, which is now close to becoming law, highlighting a number of issues as more Kill the Bill protests are planned.
It's a massive assault on our democratic right to protest in this country. Let's be clear here. This is specifically aimed at the environmental movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding that we tackle the climate emergency, and the Black Lives Matter movement, thousands of young people on the streets demanding justice for black people. And when the government saw these two movements in the summer of last year taking to the streets as they did, they decided that they needed to put in place the most draconian legislation.
Many anticipate a new wave of protest as concerns over the right of assembly grow.
And I think this will be the government's poll tax movement moment, and we'll see thousands and thousands and thousands of people in cities right across the country, as we have over the last 3 months, stepping up the campaign against this bill. But it's an absolute disaster for democracy in Britain.
The bill could also have a devastating impact on other marginalised communities in Britain.
This government is conducting a culture war. That's what he's doing. He's trying to undermine and eliminate aspects of black culture, Muslim culture, traveller culture. And when you think that people have had a way of life for thousands of years, and now you're going to introduce legislation, rather than facilitating their way of life as British people within a multicultural democracy, you're actually going to introduce a law that denies them their very way of life.
Criticism of government plans will continue amid fears that the potential damage might be irreversible.
The Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill continues to see mass opposition up and down the country, with experts deeply concerned about the potential long-term impact on civil liberties. Richard Sudam, London.
There have been several protests throughout the UK outside of the weapon manufacturing factories that have been supplying arms to the Israeli regime. Ahmed Kabaya went to the most recent one in the British northern town of Blackburn and has this report.
Hundreds of pro-Palestine protesters gathered outside the BAE Systems factory in Blackburn in the north of England to call upon the weapons manufacturer to stop supplying components for F-35 fighter jets that have been used in the recent bombardment of Gaza.
BAE, which is one of the largest companies in the UK supplying arms, parts of jets, fighter jets, to the Israeli terrorist state, which is bombing children, killing innocent people, and BAE is also funding other oppressive regimes like Saudi Arabia, and their arms are destroying the lives of innocent people.
The protest came on the back of one of the largest pro-Palestine demonstrations in British history on Saturday, and similar demonstrations throughout the week led by Palestine Action Group, who have been protesting outside the Israeli-owned Elbit Systems factory that provides drones, weapons and military hardware to the Israeli army.
We've seen protests in Leicester, Tamworth, Oldham and today in Blackburn as the anger amongst the British public begins to swell at the thought that British weapons are being used by the Israeli army to kill Palestinian children.
They're shooting kids, they're murdering little children. If that was their children, what would they say? So us lot standing here, we're going to stand out here and we're going to make noise for our people, our brothers and sisters are being oppressed. Free, free Palestine!
It's become increasingly clear that the British government's unwavering support for Israel is not representative of the feeling on the ground, with more than 383,000 Brits calling on their government to sanction the Israeli regime for their crimes against the Palestinian people. But while the UK remains complicit through the hundreds of millions of pounds worth of weapons sold to the Israeli army, some might wonder if the UK should also be held accountable. Ahmed Cabello, Blackburn.
That's all the time we have for this edition of World News. So bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Aperture.
Muhammad Iqbal, also famously known as Allama Iqbal, was a famous poet, philosopher, lawyer, and politician. Muhammad Iqbal is called the spiritual father of Pakistan, as he is believed to be the inspiration behind the historical Pakistan movement, in which he was one of the few leaders who first conceived the idea of Pakistan as a different nation for the Muslims. Iqbal is Pakistan's national poet, and his birthday is a public holiday in Pakistan. Muhammad Iqbal, also known as Iqbal Lahori, is considered one of the most important figures in Urdu literature, with literary work in both the Urdu and Persian languages. Although Urdu poetry draws heavily on Persian idiom and imagery, Iqbal found Persian more suited to his thought and temperament, and a better means of communication to a wider audience in the Indian subcontinent as well as other countries of the Muslim world. At the end, more than half and nearly two-thirds of Iqbal's poetry was in Persian language. Stay with us as this week's program looks into this extraordinary man's life and legacy.
The fragrance of the companion shall take a nation to the companion. Sometimes childhood memories appear before my eyes like a pale pall of imagination. Among those rippling images there sails the craft of my thought towards the shore of silence, to anchor in the harbor of its own. I dwell on my existence. I want to decipher the oriental thoughts and secrets, and to put an end to my bewilderment and self-alienation. I am a traveler, standing on the shore of thoughts. My aim, to pinpoint my lost identity. I am a traveler, walking on the road of human thoughts. My destination is the land of belief in oneself, in a bid to revive an identity which might no longer exist. It is an identity which, like a child's toy, is played with, but in a deadly way.
Some ignorant guys sent to the slaughterhouse of death every day thousands of innocent people because they are deeply buried in the marsh of their jejune ideas. In a way, there are two types of travels, a physical one, or going from one place to another, and a spiritual one, or transforming from one mood to another. Those embarking on the first type are many in number, and those embarking on the second type are much less. My travel is a mixture of both. Within the land and the sky, a travel in time to appreciate the ideas of an Eastern philosopher, namely Allama Muhammad Iqbal, the thinker, that if his thoughts were well understood, we would not witness the ignorant behaviors by Takfiri groups that are far from Islamic injunctions and humanity these days. Allama Iqbal wrote great mysteries in his books for his son, Javed Iqbal, and all others. As an old man, Javed knows it well whom his father was addressing. Javed talks to him like this.
Right now, I am 90 years old. You don't address people of my age. You address young people. You like them to believe what I say. I personally cannot fully understand you. I follow a path not wanted by you. Talk to me, who is 90 years old. You feel the elderly usually talk in a desperate way. You advise that one should not be desperate. The right man is hidden in you. Go on with your search. He will surely appear. You are saying the same thing. You have not visited me. I did my best. I searched for 90 years, but I did not find that right man. Where is he then? Tell me if you know.
I begin my journey right from here to the city of Sialkot, the birthplace of Iqbal. Perhaps in this travel, I would be able to show some special features of that righteous man. Today, Sialkot is a city in Punjab, Pakistan. The city, when Iqbal was born, was part of India.
Oh, you who are familiar with me, come with me to the childhood alleys. Tread on memory's pathway. Come with me to my intimate's alley. In my childhood home, on roofs quite stranger to all noises. May they be merrily remembered. The period of harmony with existence and excellence. The pleasant period of being with a companion, with all its liveliness. During all the year's generous moments, those alleys full of love, the splash of pure wafers.
ये वो घर है जहाँ अल्लामा इकबाल 9 November 1877 को सुबह 5
Here is the very room wherein Iqbal was born on the 9th of November 1877 at 5:14 a.m.
उन्होंने इस घर की इब्तिदा की
The house here was built by his grandfather, Sheikh Muhammad Rafiq. He was the first to occupy the house. On the 6th of February 1861, he bought three small rooms and a house near here until Iqbal was born. Later, Iqbal's elder brother came here. The house has undergone no change since then.
Iqbal's ancestors were high-ranking Brahmins of Kashmir. They converted to Islam 500 years before Iqbal was born. The family was called Siparu, meaning educated. His father was a cloth dealer. Nur Muhammad's shop was frequented by great thinkers of Islamic sects. His mother, Imam Bibi, was also a religious woman. Iqbal had one brother and four sisters, all of them his senior.
Rooms were built before anything else in 1861. Iqbal's family prepared the first room for the wives. There, in that room, you see a cradle and a chair.
Encouraged by his father, Muhammad Iqbal learned the Quran from his very childhood in Hissam al-Din Mosque of Kashmiris. Basic lessons were learned at home, as Iqbal says this was the best period of his lifetime, because under his father's support, his thinking foundations became established. Sialkot's graveyard tells years later, when his father died, the story of Iqbal's attachment.
Thank you.
So many times I've asked myself, what is existence? From where does it take root? What a secret it is that has attracted thinkers' attention. I could not find answers to those questions. Then, many years later, when my thoughts expanded, I traveled back to my childhood to find answers to my questions. There it was my father who decided on the shape a thing should take. Years later, when unknown things became clear to me, I came to understand Mir Hassan's teachings. He talked to me about the Book of Life, but he did not mention the book's title. A condition set before me by him was this: to learn new sciences, Europeans learn. It is only then that you come to know what the value of the Book of Life is. He was quite right. Years later, with all my heart, I came to fully know the Book of Life. The Book of Life, the Holy Quran, whose wisdom is eternal and solid. It is an illustration for life secrets. Its power makes the unfaithful faithful. To mankind, it is the only message. The bearer of it will enjoy the mercy of both worlds. Bandits turn into leaders just through its memorization. They become pious just with the help of this very book. He whose heart's pulsation is a result of the book's warmth, his restless way finds comfort just as does a pearl. Should you want to live a Muslim life, only through the Quran is this possible.
Sialkot, a city in northeastern Punjab province, located at the foot of the snow-clad Kashmiri Mountain. It was here, in this crowded city, where Allama Iqbal's first educational basis took root. Having received his first training by father and such a great teacher as Maulana Mir Hassan, the young Muhammad entered Scotch Mission School to start his official education therein. The school's premises, against passage of centuries, keeps the same shape as it used to have.
He finished his high school here in 1891. Then in 1893, he completed his 10th grade, and it was here where he finally ended his high school education in 1895 and got his high school diploma.
Having finished his high school in Sialkot, Muhammad Iqbal found the city too small to give him an opportunity to fly higher up in the sky. Muhammad was 18 when he finished his pre-university courses with honors, receiving 2 academic gold medals. Admitted on a scholarship, he left Sialkot for Lahore as advised by his teacher Mir Hassan. Lahore was a city southwest of his birthplace, 125 kilometers away from it. Then Muhammad Iqbal went to Punjab University, one of Pakistan's oldest universities, established in 1882 by the British ruler of the Indian subcontinent in Lahore. There, the instruction language was English, though some lessons were taught in Urdu. Young Iqbal of Sialkot went there to continue his education. Very soon, he got so famous throughout the world due to his thoughts and his Persian Urdu poems. Known as Iqbal Lahori, he was destined to get his BA and MA here and composed his earliest poems.
Allama Iqbal bila shuba hamari islami duniya ka.
Undoubtedly, Iqbal is, for us in the world of Islam, a clear metaphor and a great name. Iqbal found in Islamic world a special thought. At the present time, we are living in a place so blessed as it witnessed Iqbal, the learned, for 5 years. At a time when Iqbal arrived here from Sialkot to enroll for BA, the state university here had this one dormitory only. Iqbal lived here for 5 years. I mean, his presence here lasted about 5 years. He then enrolled for MA in philosophy. He completed his MA.
Iqbal, as it seems to me, went through two periods in his life, a wisdom period and a love period.
During the time Iqbal was still in the subcontinent, and when he had not yet left for the West, he was naturally well acquainted with Western philosophy, had deeply studied Hinduism and Islamic thoughts.
At that time, Iqbal was quite familiar with Indian mysticism, and the traces of that school of thought can be found in his poems.
He studied in depth our religion, and with such a deep knowledge, he left for the West.
There was no ending to the stories of my restlessness and abandoning similar places. I was 28 when, recommended by my teacher, Sir Thomas Arnold, I left for Europe to continue my studies. Having a master's degree in philosophy, I had taught at the Oriental College, but going to England and starting study at Cambridge University for a doctorate in philosophy changed everything. Studying at Cambridge secured me opportunities to know better and more about Western philosophers. At the same time, I enrolled at the Faculty of Law to be able to get permission to act as attorney. The rest had no meaning to me. For that very year, I traveled to Hamburg, Germany, to do more research and finish my doctoral dissertation. For a whole year, I worked so hard to get fully familiar with philosophical foundations and to get my doctoral thesis finished. At that time, I made much of well-known philosophy teachers, such as the famous professor of philosophy, McNicrad, and the famous Orientalist, Reinhold Elin Nicholson.
He continued his university studies in Heidelberg, Germany, and became familiar with the thoughts and ideas of such philosophers as Nietzsche, Fichte, Schopenhauer, and the like. There were similarities between his thoughts and the thoughts of those learned men.
Iqbal continues to say that he was changing and thinking those days.
Interestingly enough, Iqbal was influenced by Western philosophers. He adopted their thoughts and opinions. He received ideas from them, but mixed them with his own to create an independent thought system and called it own philosophy.
Having received his doctor of philosophy, Iqbal returned at the age of 31 to Lahore. Never did he hesitate to return home, contrary to some students of that time. He left England quickly. He was then licensed to practice attorneyship and became a member of Lahore Bar Association. 3 years later, he became a lecturer in philosophy at Lahore University. He resigned after a while to exclusively practice as an attorney. This way, he was able to freely publish his thoughts. He continuously thought about finding a way to awaken Muslims taken captive by colonialism.
All my life has been coincident with the Indian subcontinent's darkest days, British colonialism, and now World War I. India was dominated by colonialism since the 18th century, but as World War I began in August 1914, a new form of cruelty began to cover my land. Indians went to fight a war wherein they had played no role. They were killed and killed for people who themselves were the main factor in bringing ruin and destruction to the whole world. Description of troubles brought about by those calamities is actually impossible.
In 1910 and 1911, and after World War I, we see a number of liberation movements. Muslims rose against British and European colonizers. So Iqbal found himself on a well-defined route. He started composing revolutionary poems.
After World War I, in 1918, and the fall of the Ottoman Empire, something had to be done quickly to save people of the tyranny imposed on them. I knew that a worldwide caliphate was no longer practicable. There was no agreement between Islamic unity and blind religious prejudice or extreme nationalistic ideas as promulgated by colonial powers. Unwillingly, I engaged in political activities. I tried to raise public awareness to bring about self-reliance.
Allama ran for Punjab parliament election. As he said, he hated political activities and Muslims' needs forced him to enter the political arena. Consequently, he joined the Muslim League Party. He succeeded to become an MP for Punjab province for 3 years. During that time, he tried to solve Muslims' problems. Iqbal used to talk on such problems.
Allama Iqbal nurtured a wish for an independent Pakistan. He would say a new country, an Islamic country, would come into existence on the world map. The country's name, he would say, will be Pakistan. Iqbal did not give this name to a new country, but surely he had it as a Muslim country in mind.
During my lifetime, I liked those sleeping in the world of thought to wake up from their deep sleep. But sadly, the sleep is too deep. Therefore, I took refuge in the world of rhythmic words and meaningful poems to awaken the youths of this sorrowful nation in order to sail the craft of our thoughts to the shore of productivity. I was a young man when I found out that to weather horrible tempests and the enemy's lurking place, we had no way but recourse to the miracle of the last time. The Holy Quran, the book with miraculous words, which can be used as the best means to awaken thought and exalt the belief in self. The book is most succoring, particularly to the youth. I, who despair of the sages of old, have a word to say touching the day to come. Render my speech easy unto the young. Make my abyss for them attainable.
This is
This
for
is
a better life.
For a better life.
فرمود بعثتُ لأتمم مكارم الأخلاق.
The Holy Prophet of Islam says, "I have been sent to complete noble manners."
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum warahmatullahi wabarakatuh. I would like to begin this episode with a question. Who was the first person, the very first person who rebelled against Allah? Who was he? You all know. The first person who transgressed and crossed the limits was Shaitan, Satan. He refused to submit to Allah. He rebelled him. When, of course, Allah wanted him to obey him, but he rebelled. Shaitan was a good creature in the beginning. He was worshipping Allah. He was submissive. But when Allah put him to a serious test by asking him to show his respect to Adam, he stubbornly refused. He said, "Because I am much better than Adam. Who the heck is Adam? I'm not going to bow to Adam." خَلَقْتَنِ مِن نَار وَخَلَقْتَهُ مِن تِين. So Shaitan was stubborn, Shaitan was selfish, and Shaitan was proud of himself because he was proud of having been created from fire, while man, insan, was created from mud, from clay. Okay. He was saying, "Okay, my race is white and his race is black." That's what we are saying nowadays. That's what we see, at least in the world. Some people say, "I am European, I'm so and so. I'm not going to respect someone who is poor, who comes from so and so country." So it is all because of selfishness, because of arrogance, because of stubbornness, and because of pride. It's all because of this that he says, "I'm not going to do this, I'm not going to that to do that." Shaitan was very much, yes, like this. Shaitan did not submit to Allah and he did not obey Allah because he was proud. Allah the Exalted, the Almighty, says the true essence, the true act of worship, ibadah, is that when you are willing to submit to Allah. That's the main essence of ibadah. Worshipping Allah is all about submitting to Allah. Every cell in your body yearns Him, submits to Him, and worships Him. There is a verse in the Quran which says, "Qul inna salati wa nusuki wa mahyaya wa mamati lillahi rabbil alamin." Say that my prayer, my rituals, my life, and my death are all for Allah, the Lord of the worlds. So that's all about, ibadah is all about submission. Okay? Not only your actions, your feelings, your aspirations, your sentiments must be directed to Allah. If you love someone, you must love him for the sake of Allah. If you hate something, you should hate for the sake of Allah. Every cell in your body submits to Allah. And that's what submission is about. That's what the religion of Islam is about. Religion has two dimensions, two sides. One is the exterior, which is very visible. Everyone can see the exterior. What is the exterior of faith? Prayers, the fasting, when you don't eat and drink, the Hajj, the charity that you give, and the jihad. These are the exterior of the religion, the outward aspect of the religion. Okay? But the interior of Islam and the essence of Islam is the submission to Allah. The inner faith and belief in Islam, which is invisible to the eyes, that is the true essence. The true essence of Islam is submission. And you have to believe that when it comes to Allah, you are nothing but subservient to Allah, the Almighty. You submit to Allah willfully, truly, utterly, and completely. And you are subservient to Allah with all your heart, body, and soul.
changed the desert into oasis. We built buildings of different lengths and sizes, and we felt so very satisfied. We bought and bought and couldn't stop buying. We gave charity to the poor cause we couldn't stand the crying. We thought we paid our dues, but in fact to ourselves we're just lying. Oh, I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. I'm walking with my head lowered in shame for my place. I'm walking with my head lowered for my race. Yes, it's easy to blame everything on the West, when in fact our focus should be on ourselves. Is it satisfied? Is Allah satisfied? Is Allah satisfied?
Man reaches a degree of belief where he declares his nothingness before Allah. That is the true faith. That is the true faith. This is how you measure your faith. This is a scale on which you put your faith and you measure it. Okay? And you see whether you really have faith. And if you have faith, do you have 50% faith, complete faith, or incomplete faith? Or you have no faith at all? Okay? In fact, this is the essence. This is the meaning of love. When you love someone, you are prepared to do everything for him. You are willing to do everything for him. If he tells you to call him before going to bed, you call him. If he tells you to call him every 30 minutes, you call him. If he tells you to pick him from the street, you would do so. If he tells you, wait for me in the street in the cold, you will definitely do it, as people do it. We can see it. If he tells you to wait for him in the road and it's raining, you will do that. You will never say no to him because you love that person. Prophet Sulaiman saw an ant in the desert carrying some dust from one end to another. Sulaiman, who had the ability of communicating with animals and insects, said, "What are you doing there?" The ant said, "I'm carrying dust from this side to the other side." He said, "Why are you doing this?" She said, "I am in love. I am in deep love with someone who asked me to do so, and I'm just listening to him." Sulaiman said to her, "But the dust here is too much, and this is a big mountain of dust. You will not be able to carry all the dust even if you live the life of Noah. Are you going to spend all your life doing this? You are going to die soon or late. You cannot do that." She said to him, "Ya Sulaiman, dying in the way of love and in the line of duty towards someone you love is much better and comforting for you." "Yes, even if I die, it does not matter because I'm dying for him." Sulaiman received the message that even in our death, we have to die for our Lord, the Glorified. قُلْ إِنَّ صَلَاتِي وَنُسُكِي وَمَحْيَايَ وَمَمَاتِ لِلَّهِ رَبِّ الْعَالَمِينَ. Of course, not only your activities and prayers, but your death should also be for him. Your life and death, your beginning and your end should be for him. That is the true essence of faith. We live for Allah and completely submit to him. فَلَا وَرَبَّكَ لَا يُؤْمِنُونَ حَتَّى يُحَكِّمُوكَ فِي مَا شَجَرْ بَيْنَهُمْ ثُمَّ لَا يَجُدُ فِي أَنفُسِهِمْ حَرَجًا مِمَّا قَضَيْتَ وَيَسَلِّمُ تَسْلِيمًا. But know, by your Lord, they do not believe in reality until they make you a judge of that which has become a matter of disagreement among them. And this is the translation of the verse. And then do not find any straightness in their hearts as to what you have decided, and submit with entire submission. And that's the end of this episode. Inshallah, we will carry on this discussion. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Your mercy, your love is all I need. So all I need. So all I need.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.